You are listening to Fresh Oil, a podcast that examines the human condition while coming to terms with the purpose of life.
Hi, my name is Bill Haas, and I'm an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. I am a follower of Jesus Christ, and I'm excited about the opportunities that God has given me to bring the saving gospel to my people. You know, for over 500 years, missions has been on this continent trying to reach the indigenous peoples of North America. And yet, at the current hour, we are about 3 to 5% evangelized in this continent. And there's a great task ahead. And I appreciate your time and taking your time today to listen to this podcast.
Excellent, Bully. That's great. I can edit all the fluff.
Right.
Okay, so I'm going to do the introduction and we will begin forthwith,
all right.
Okay? Hello, you're listening to Fresh Oil with Billy Delaney. This week I have a special interview. We're going to be going deeper with Bill Haas, friend of mine for over 35 years, a missionary who has served and worked in French-speaking Quebec, Cambodia, North America, and Oklahoma, and is now in Rhinelander in the Northwoods of the United States, working with First Tribes and the peoples of America. So, hello, Billy. How are you?
I'm doing great, Billy. Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. Hello, Billy. Hello, Billy. That's funny. I love it.
Couple of billy goats.
Yeah, that's about the size of it, buddy. Okay. Whenever we do this interview with people, we cover three topics. We cover what's going on inside your head. What are you thinking about? And then what we want to know is, what brings you satisfaction in your work? What are you doing with your hands? And the kind of work that you're engaged in, whether that be physical or metaphor. And then we come down into the hard part of the interview. For a lot of people, it's where they really open up. And we start talking about the questions of your heart. Where's your heart at? What's going on? And those kinds of things. And then very lastly, I asked all my audience and all my listeners of my audience three questions, and then we give you some time at the very end to take what you want to say to everybody about the things that are going on, whether it be the work in Rhinelander, whether it be other events or things. I keep up with your website, and I see quite a bit of what's going on with suicide and things like that, and I'm sure that's on your heart, but we'll get to that in a little bit, okay? You
right,
ready?
Ready.
Okay, let's go deeper with Billy Haas. I'm going to ask you an opening question here. And it'll get this thing rolling a little bit. Would you tell me a favorite story about working in your youth when you were a wee lad?
Oh, a favorite story about working. Well, there's several of those, but I'd have to say that one that really comes to mind would be back when I was young. I used to work on a farm. And, I like being outdoors. I'm Native American, and I don't know if that helps me with the love of outdoors. I don't know if I'm naturally attracted to that because of my genetic background and makeup or anything like that, but I always liked being outside. And when my people were basically force marched from southwestern Michigan to Kansas, before that they were hunters and gatherers. And then when they were relocated and removed to Kansas, they had to learn the fine art of farming. And my grandfather was a farmer. My dad grew up on a farm, and I'd always, grown up in town, but I had an opportunity as a young man to work on a farm, and it was my first experience at milking cows, and that was hilarious. I wish that somebody had videotaped that one. I'd have to say the highlight of that experience was actually going up into the mountains near the edge of the farm there, and cutting down trees and hooking them up the old-fashioned way to the horses and having the horses pull the logs down to the road where we could load them on a wagon. And I don't know, it's just the outdoors, and it was just a great experience. I had a Christian guy that I worked with, and it was nice to get out in the fresh air and just have an opportunity to talk to a guy. The world is filled with so much negativity, and yet I think looking back on that was a real positive experience for me to be out there with another guy who just loved being outdoors, and we just had a wonderful time. It's great memories.
Okay. That's pretty good, Billy. I have yet to get somebody on here that says, I didn't do any work as a kid. I played Nintendo. But I might bump into, that might come along. But the kind of people I'm talking with, that doesn't happen. So, first question on deck for you, Billy, is where do you do your best thinking?
Wow. Where do I do my best thinking? I'm going to go back to follow up on the previous question. I like doing my best thinking outdoors. I have a deck out behind my house that I sit on sometimes. Right now, I'm not sitting out on it because it's around zero outside. But normally I'm out walking in the woods. Now I can bundle up and put on a pair of snowshoes and go out in the woods and just go out for a walk in the woods. And I enjoy thinking there. I enjoy thinking there's a lake just down the road from the house. I like to go to the lake and just sit beside the lake and do some thinking there or alongside a stream. I'm a real outdoors kind of guy.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that you like to think about the most?
What do I like to think about the most? Wow. I'm going to have to say, it's kind of an odd one, but my wife, she works at a clinic nearby. And, you know, I do a lot of things. I travel a lot of places. I'm in the car a lot, going places and doing things. And I think a lot of the times I think about, you know, where I'm at. For example, if I'm in another state somewhere working with a group of Native Americans and I have some sort of experience there in the sense of it's something beautiful or it's something rewarding, I find myself always saying, I wish that Cindy was here. And I tell you what takes up a lot of my thought is just dreaming. I'd like to reach a place one day in our ministry where my wife doesn't have to work outside the ministry and can do more with me in ministry on a daily basis. I can't tell you how many times I've been in a situation and said, man, I wish Cindy was here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On that same line about when you get alone and you're thinking, we're talking about getting inside you a little bit, inside your head. Who inspires you to do your thinking?
Wow.
I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about when like this. Like for me, General Patton inspires me to think when I read his books or I read his quotes, which I do regularly, or sometimes A.W. Tozier will say something, and that'll inspire me to think. So do you have people like that that you sort of have a roll call in your mind that inspire you to think?
Yeah, I had to say ditto on the A.W. Tozer. I really, really enjoy reading him. Do a lot of reading. I'm a voracious reader. I like to read his work. Chesterton, sometimes I'll read his work, G.K. Chesterton. And then not only that, but Native American works, Red Cloud. I read a lot of Native American works. There's some things out by Red Cloud. And, you know, those things motivate me.
Mm-hmm.
My Native American history. There's a lot of things in my Native American history that get me thinking about things.
Whenever you think like this and you're inspired by these people that you admire, obviously, do you think with a pencil and paper in hand or a digital device or something like that to capture your thoughts?
Both.
tell me a little bit about that.
Well, both are helpful. One of the things, I guess, about the digital age is you sure better do a backup. You know, but then I've learned this, though. Yeah. In the old days, it was just as easy to lose a piece of paper as it is to fail to backup nowadays. And so no matter what media you're using, whether it's digital or old-fashioned pen and paper, you know, you better be ready to take care of it. And if it's digital, you better back it up. And if it's paper, you better file it. You better have it somewhere handy. I try to do that. I try to journal a little bit. I probably could do some improvement in that area where I probably ought to be doing it daily. I'm probably doing it like weekly, something like that. But I try to write things down when I'm thinking. We even thought about getting a digital voice recorder, especially when I'm in the car and I'm driving somewhere. I could just turn that thing on and, you know, when I'm thinking about something, just talk right into the digital voice recorder.
Mm-hmm. And your notes. Do you use any particular system like mind mapping? Do you use any particular books like Moleskine notebooks or just general jotters and pencils and paper and things like that?
Those Mead spiral notebooks.
They work for
me
too,
man.
That's
what I use.
I use them and I use Moleskines and rapidographic pens and things like that. And move along down and through there. Here's a question. Mm-hmm. What is it you like to think about least?
Wow. I don't like to think about getting old.
I thank you for that honest answer, and I can enjoy it with you because I feel it. I thought when I turned 50 it was going to be tough. And then when I hit 55, I realized what people were talking about, the aches and pains.
Right. When I started getting AARP stuff in the mail, I got worried.
I welcome it now because I've decided to just fight back and not act the age they want
me
to be.
I think I'm in the same place, fighting back. I'm a nostalgic kind of guy. And, you know, lately there's been a lot of death in the news, you know, music icons and people that I grew up when I was, you know, still in puberty and, you know, and they're dying and old and, you know, I can't do what I used to do. I can't move like I used to move. You know, I was an athlete in school and now I'm 56 years old and I can't do the things I used to do. I mean, I climbed Pike's Peak when I was 35 years old. I wouldn't even attempt to do that today.
No. I notice in Hawaii, they've got mountains and they see these people going up in flip-flops and shorts and they're out of shape and I'm going, that's not going to end well. And unfortunately, I'm right because a lot of times they have to life flight them out of there. They're up there sunburnt. They can't come down the hill in the flip-flops. They're sick. They're dehydrated. You know, they took two beers and a pop with them and that sort of thing.
Right.
Not outdoorsy people, I'm afraid. So this is what's going on inside your head. I know that Cambodia, Montreal, and now up in the Northwoods. What do you think about these things whenever you get seated and you're in the different areas, and how do you adjust? What's your thinking process on that?
Well, I look around me. You know, there are several reservations in this area. I guess probably the area that I work ministry-wise is about 40,000 square miles up here. It's a big territory. And there's probably 10, 12, 13 reservations in that area. And I look around and I see the hopelessness and I see the despair and I see the suicide and the things that all around me, and my heart just breaks. I guess if I probably was going to relate to a Bible character, I'd probably relate to Jeremiah. You know, just the heartbreak, the weeping, the despair, you know, I carry their burden. Their burden's my burden. I mean, my people were force marched from Southwest Michigan to Kansas in the mid 1800s at the point of bayonet.
That's not a good history point.
No. And I drive around this area here around the Great Lakes is the land where my people came from. And I drive around here and sometimes, Billy, I look at this place and I look at this land and I look at these forests and I look at these lakes and my heart just begins to weep because my people were willing to fight for this. And it breaks my heart. And now I see a group of people that were once a very proud people, a very noble people who've been reduced to despair and tragedy. And it's a heartache to me. It really is.
Well, we'll get to that a little bit more when we come down to looking at your heart. And I know that that's stuff that's still very present in your head. And you were sort of leading towards the next area that we're going to go into. And that's in working with your hands. You know, that's an awful lot of land and a big area that you're trying to work in and that you're trying to take care of. And here's a question. What's your biggest challenge in doing what you're doing there now?
When talking to my people about Jesus Christ, there's a huge problem, there's a huge hurdle that has to be overcome. And it's a hurdle from history. I don't know how many of the listeners know a lot about American history. I know it's not, there's a lot of gaps in our history being taught, but people claiming to be Christians and coming to my people in the past in the name of Christ, while doing so, did horrific things to Native American people, all the while claiming that it was the right and Christian thing to do. And that presents a really big challenge for me when I'm trying to bring my people to a true and biblical understanding of Jesus Christ and who he is. Mm-hmm. Many of my people are very skeptical, very angry at Christianity. And that's a big challenge, because there's this, when you get to them, there's this wall that you've got to tear down first. Because they feel they've been burnt, they've been taken advantage of, they've been lied to, they have been abused. And a lot of these people who did this had a Bible under their arm.
Okay. How do you go about overcoming that, Billy?
Well, I think one of the things that I've found to be effective here is going back to the beginning and beginning to show them who God is, who is Jesus Christ, because the wall that comes up is a wall that says, oh, that's the white man's gospel. That's the white man's Jesus. But the Hebrews were a tribal people, much like us Native American people. One of the producers of a Native American movie called Smoke Signals, named was Sherman Alexie, and he drew a comparison between the Jewish people and our Native First Nations people. And I've been thinking about a lot of the things that he said and some of the similarities between the persecuted Jewish people and Native American people. For example, both are a tribal people. Both groups have an incredible sense of humor, but that sense of humor is born out of pain and suffering. Thanksgiving, the coming of Europeans to North America was not exactly a happy day for Native America. We as Native Americans, I believe Native Americans are very spiritual people. They're in many ways lost and don't have, the key to spiritual knowledge, who is Jesus Christ. But because we're Indian, we give thanks every day, not just one day a year. But the joke among Native people is, but those white people sure do cook some good food in November. we have a sense of humor, but the sense of humor comes out of pain and suffering. For example, people come and ask all the time, are you full-blooded? And the joke from a Native American is, no, I'm a pint short. I just came from the Red Cross. Both groups are survivors of ethnic cleansing. Both are traditional people. Both, by and large, have rejected the gospel of Jesus Christ. Both groups, if they embrace the gospel of Jesus Christ, are going to be ostracized by their own people. Both of those groups of people have been displaced from their homeland at one time or another. All these things. And so when I sit down and talk with a Native American person, I try to get them to see Jesus Christ and see the similarities between him and his people, the nation of Israel, and see that it's so close, it parallels the life experience of a Native American throughout history.
That's an interesting observation, Billy, and a good parallel. And it looks like you found a very good way to bring them information about what you're discussing.
Yep, to bridge the gap.
Yep. So let me ask you another question in relationship to this challenge and how you overcome it. What scares you the most about doing what you're doing when you're engaged with these people? What scares you the most?
Failure. Standing before the Creator one day and having these immense regrets that I didn't do everything that I possibly could do to bridge that gap between God and my people. It's so sad because so many of my people are so close. They have this spiritual nature. They have this, they believe in a Creator. A lot of people think that my people are, a worshiper of many gods, polytheistic, but most Native American people are actually monotheistic. And they do believe in one true God. They call him the Great Spirit. Gishe Manadu in our native language. And the problem is they just, many of them haven't made the connection that the Creator became a man and dwelt in the flesh. And that scares me. It scares me that they're so close and yet they're so far. Mm-hmm. That really bothers me.
Okay. So what kind of way do you go about tempering some of these scares, fears, emotions that are there to prevent you from, you know, going into burnout or something like that?
Summer youth camp always helps with that. It comes around every year, last week of June. Nothing tempers that more than going to our annual summer Native American youth camp and seeing a couple of hundred Native American young warriors understand that truth about Jesus Christ and what he did on Calvary, and then begin a new life and a new relationship. See, they understand the concept of Creator God. And when they realize that they can know the Creator and that the Creator made the effort to come down here and become a man and walk among them, when that spiritual awakening happens inside of them, and they realize that they were created for so much more than what they're experiencing on the reservation, that is that thing that gets me, over the hump, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, you kind of jumped ahead of me here. And one of the questions that I've got is, what excites you the most and why?
See,
and you jump right on it. You jump right into it.
That. Well, you know, suicide rates are from 3 to 9 times the national average on our reservations, depending on which reservation. And when I see a broken relationship restored, you know, I think about, you know, Milton's work, you know, Paradise Lost, Paradise Regained and Restored and all that. And when I see a broken relationship restored through Jesus Christ, you know, paradise can be understood as being with God even before heaven. Mm-hmm. Paradise is walking with him now. And just like back in the Garden of Eden, paradise was lost because of sin. And when my people understand that paradise can be regained, paradise can be restored, my excitement is seeing my people just embrace that and come to Jesus.
Well, here's a question that deals with the work that you do. And I know you've been diverse and you've worked in Cambodia and up in Montreal. I visited with you up there. Would you do something else if the opportunity arose?
I'd do anything that God asked me to do, but having this November, I will have been walking with Jesus Christ for 50 years. So a half a century this November, there'll be my spiritual birthday, 50 years. And I just cannot see that happening. I think that God has given me an understanding that, you know, I'm 56 years old. I'm near the end of my race. He's given me my life work, and I'm right in the middle of it right now. And I'm not saying that he couldn't shake things up for me, but I can't see that happening. I can't see myself doing anything else. And I think the reason why is I think God's just given me a peace that this is where you're going to stay. You're going to work with your people. You're going to plant churches among your people until I come, or until I leave this world in a box.
Okay. That's a very interesting response. And I'm very curious about a couple of other things in relationship to this. What's the difference between working in the Northwoods with the First Nations and the difference between working with the Cambodian people, and who share many similar traits? They're pretty spiritually minded about things, aren't they?
Yeah, there are a lot of similarities between working in Cambodia and working among my native people. Animistic culture would be the first thing that comes to mind. The Cambodians, although predominantly Buddhist, it's very mixed between Buddhism and animism. And so they do worship, or maybe for lack of a better word, worship the spirit world. They at least acknowledge the powers in the spirit world and give satisfy the spirit world in order to remove curses and things like that. And so there are a lot of similarities between the religious mindset and worldview of a Cambodian Buddhist and a North American First Nations person. A lot of similarities. And I think actually Cambodia was pretty good training for working with my own people.
I see. How did Quebec sit in the midst of all of that?
Oh, mais oui, monsieur.
C'est bien ça.
My heritage is French and Indian. And where I'm at right now used to be the French part of North America. And so as I work in the culture here, it's not only an Indian culture, it's a French culture as well. And I think that a lot of the things that we learned in Quebec, as we planted a church there, Victory Bible Baptist Church in Montreal, which is a good church and it's still going well. In fact, it's a very multicultural church in Montreal, right outside one of the metro subway stations with, I can't even tell you how many different nationalities of people attend the church. But one of the things I think that Quebec has done to help us with our ministry today is, and that was our first ministry as a married couple, my wife and I. I think that it helped us solidify some things early on as far as foundational issues and why we're doing what we're doing, whether it be in Quebec or Cambodia or North America. But, I've learned a lot of things about my ancestral background. Actually my people on my dad's side came out of Quebec. Didn't even know that when I was serving the Lord there. But I always wondered why French came so easily to me. Maybe there's a genetic connection and I was just
predisposed
to learn French.
Well, I know that you know that I'm using Duolingo now, and I'm rolling through that every day. And before my life ends, I will be able to definitely get by in France, and I will go visit it in my retiring years if I do, because that's where I originally wanted to be. And circumstances may be like you, taking me the long road round. Right. So I want to change things up a little bit. We've talked about your head and where your thinking is and how you think and the tools that you use a little bit, the toughest things you think about and stuff like that. And now we've definitely got into what you're doing with your hands, metaphorically or physically. And I've seen pictures on Facebook of you being out in the woods and stuff like that. And some of the pictures from some of the places you visited with the tribes. And I've enjoyed those. Do you have a dog?
I did until I moved to Wisconsin. We are renting a house, and he said no dogs. But we are dog people.
Yep. I asked that for I've left it off a couple of interviews because I wasn't sure how it fit in. But I was visiting a friend of mine, and he had a poster on the wall, and it said, "Dog's tails don't lie." And one of the things he said was, "Billy, whenever you come in the house, the first thing I do is look at my dog's tails." Right. He says, "If they wag, you're all right.
Exactly.
if they don't wag, I got to be wondering."
I'm glad you asked the question. It's funny that you did mention that because it's kind of a family joke around our house. You know, every stray cat and stray dog attaches itself to me. before we moved up here. Funny story. Before we moved up here to the Northwoods, I needed to borrow a lawnmower and from a friend. And I'm talking to him on the phone. He says, "Yeah, it's at my house. There's a little fenced-in enclosure behind my house." I said, "Yeah, I know what you're talking about." He said, "Well, the lawnmower's in there and it's unlocked. All you got to do is just go in and get it." He said, "But you need to watch out for my dogs." And he had two guard dogs, and he said, "I really prefer that you wait and go with me because I'm not sure how the dogs are going to react to you just pulling up and taking something from the property. He was a little concerned for my safety. So I ignored him and went on to get the mower. And I pulled up in my pickup truck and I got out and I saw the dogs and they were coming towards me. Well, I just dropped to one knee. I said, come on, boy, come on, come on, boy. And they, those two dogs came and they ran into me and they started licking my face. And I rolled over on my back and they were licking me all over and licking my hand. Well, I had the quick thinking to pull my cell phone out of my pocket. And I just did a selfie with the cell phone and took a picture of his dogs licking me and sent it to him in a text message. And I said, I met your dogs and they love me. And he sent me a text back with a response that said, don't tell anyone.
The reason I ask is I'm a dog lover. I'm on number seven going through my adult years and proven to be a very enjoyable experience with the dog, all the things that bring with it. And that kind of lightens it up a little bit, lets us let some of the topic that we have already covered slide away. And now I'm going to talk about you and what's going on inside your heart and the things that make Billy Haas who he is. Yeah. And old Bob Jones Sr. said this. He said, the right road leads out at the right place. And in the heart, I think that there's where the journey on the road is really lived. Not in the head and not in the hands. You can do any kind of work. You can do all kinds of thinking. But they're ephemeral. Some of them are just Monday to Friday getting the paycheck. But when it comes to what's inside the heart, that's a little bit different. So how hard for you is it to be yourself? Because you're a guy that's, I mean, one minute you're in Cambodia, the next minute you're Quebec, and now you're in the Northwoods. We were driving a truck in Oklahoma for a while after you came back. Many faceted, like myself, you've put your hand to many different things. And inside all of that, there's always the presentation of who you are at that given moment. But how hard is it for you to be yourself?
It's not hard at all. In fact, if my wife were here in the room right now, she'd be laughing at this question. That probably gets me into more trouble than anything is just being me. it's not hard for me to be myself at all. It comes really easily, Billy.
Okay. Well, that's kind of an easy kind of lead into... We're on the right road, and we're looking to get down that road to an end that we are satisfied with, that we feel I've done my work. What do you do to keep yourself on track?
Well, of course, I talk with my wife about things, and that's really important. But I'm, my wife and I now, we're in our mid-50s now, and Cindy's had her share of health problems, and
I've seen that and I know that.
Yeah, we're not spring chickens anymore. And Cindy may not always be here. And so, keeping myself on track, I've come to an understanding that even though I have friends and I have my wife, I've got to let God talk to me through the scriptures. And I talk to him in prayer. And that comes first because my wife may not always be here for me to talk to her about things. And, because life is like a vapor, the scripture says in James, it's here today, and it's gone tomorrow. And so I better know how to commune with God more than anyone else. And so that's how I keep myself on track. I try to listen to wise counsel. And of course, the first place for wise counsel is in the scripture. And then, of course, there are other sources of wise counsel as well.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question. When do you know you're not on track?
When do I know when I'm not on track? When I avoid the Bible. when I avoid the Bible, I know I'm off track because I don't want to hear what he has to say. And I'm off track.
Okay. As you know, I call it the unknown book.
And my wife and my children also let me know when I'm off track. If I go off the rails, my wife She's here. I have one daughter that lives here in Wisconsin. The other daughter lives in Texas. And but my daughter that lives here and my wife, they're not hesitant at all to let me know when I've gone off the rails. That's a good thing.
That's a very good thing. It kind of leads into a little bit of what I'm talking about in the heart. A lot of people don't want to go to anybody for help, and it sounds like in the First Nations, they don't know who to go to for help. When they watch you, do you purposefully turn to someone for help that they can observe?
Do I turn to someone for help?
Who do you turn to for help, and do you allow other people seeing you seeking mm-hmm. that help because of the obvious benefits for those watching?
Yeah, I do. I think there's kind of a spirit in this age that I don't need anybody to help me. You know, I can do this on my own. I don't need anyone's help. And you know, I think Native American indigenous people, we pride ourselves in being a spiritual people, but we are very lost in many ways. And, you know, when I was a kid, I had the guidance of my elders, you know, my great grandparents, my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles, my mom, my dad. They guided me in a Christ-centered path towards spiritual understanding. In other words, they said, you know, you can be Native and you can still be a Christian. And so I turn to people for help, and I let people see me do that. You know, I let I let people see me pray. I let people hear me pray. You know, Jesus, you know, he let the disciples hear him pray. And, you know, he was dependent upon his Father. And so I want our people to see me cry out to God and ask God for things, because then when God answers those prayers and sees those things accomplished, they'll say, I remember Billy praying that. And so it's a vivid lesson to my people to see and hear me asking God for something, asking God for help, and then watching God move and watching God work, and them seeing a real living picture of that in real life. That's discipleship.
Yes, it is. And in your heart, where you live, where Billy Haas lives, do you have and have you been given a tribal name?
No, I have not. I look forward to that, but I have been delaying that for a long time.
Tell me a little bit about why that is or how that comes about.
My father was a godly man. He was a Christian, but he was opposed to that. He was a guy that's basically said, he had a real difficult time. I think it had a lot to do with people who taught him. It goes back to that historical question, that historical matter that we talked about before, where Native American people, when they were reached with the gospel by missionaries, even though they meant well, even though the missionaries and the preachers meant well, they did a lot of things to try to take Native American culture from the people. One of those things was the language. They didn't want Native American people speaking their language. They didn't want Native American people using traditional Native instruments to worship Jesus Christ. They didn't want Native American people dancing. They didn't want Native American people to express their worship in ways that were distinctively and culturally Native American. I've had a rethinking about a lot of those things through the years. You know, coming full circle now, and I think we did a great disservice to my Native people in telling them that they had to abandon all those things. You know, I've been all around the world. You know that, Billy. I've been to Russia. You go to Russia, they do every. I mean, when I've been to a Baptist church in Russia, and you can tell you're in Russia. They sing Russian songs. They have Russian clothing. They have Russian instruments. They do things Russian. I've been to Latin America. I've been to Cuba. I've been to Puerto Rico. I've been to Mexico. I've been to the Mayan Indians. I've been to Cambodia, Philippines, Vietnam. I've been all over. And everywhere I go, if you go into an Indonesian church in Southeast Asia, you're going to know you're in an Indonesian church. They're going to use Indonesian instruments. But for some reason, whatever happened historically on this continent, you know, my people kind of got the idea from missionaries that God loves you, John 3:16, but he doesn't like you. He doesn't like your culture. He doesn't like your hair. He doesn't like your dance. He doesn't like your regalia. He doesn't like your jewelry. He doesn't like your drum. He doesn't like anything about you. And it seems that, you know, I mean, for example, you know, churches all across America have drums in them. The difference between their drum and an Indian drum is that their drum says Yamaha on it. You know, but if you take an Indian drum and put it in a worship service, I guess you need to get a magic marker and write the word Yamaha on it. So then all of a sudden it becomes a Christian evangelical drum. You know, I mean, there's all these things. And my dad was kind of caught up in that. And, yeah.
And that affected him taking a tribal name?
Yeah, he did not take one. And, you know, to honor my father's wishes, I never did do that while he was alive.
How does that happen, Billy? How does a tribal name get bestowed, or how does it come about?
Well, it usually comes about, if it doesn't happen young in life through the working of the parents and grandparents, then it usually comes about through the tribe. It comes about through the chief or the chairman, whatever the particular tribe calls their leader these days. And usually the member of the tribe will request it, or some other member of the tribe will suggest it. It's been suggested for me by another member of the tribe that I get a native name. I was honored a couple years ago with the gift of an eagle feather, which is a great honor. And
what does that symbol?
It symbolizes that you've made some accomplishments in your life that, you know, not everybody can possess an eagle feather. You know, Native Americans, at least under American law, are the only ones that can possess eagle feathers. And I think what happens is, you know, at least in my tribe, is that if you're recognized as having made some sort of accomplishment, positive accomplishment in your life, then you're honored with an eagle feather. It basically just says you're a good warrior.
I see.
So I've received that honor, and I'm very grateful and very, very privileged. I'm very humbled by it.
And do you think somewhere in the road you're traveling that you will accept the name?
Yes, probably within the next year or two.
Okay, I would like to know what that name becomes.
I will definitely let you know that, yes.
I would definitely like to know that. Now, we're winding it down a little bit. It's been very interesting, fascinating for me, and I've known you a very long time, to see this flourishing in your life and landing at this fulfilling place for you. Now, the three things I ask everybody on the interview, and some of them are taken back by it. Some of them don't know how to answer it. Some of them are very open and clear on it. So here's the first question. And I want you to give it a little thought, because we are benefits of generosity in the work that we've done in the years we've lived. But this isn't the same thing. Have you ever been the recipient of real charity?
Expound on the question just a little more for me.
Okay. Well, love is an emotion. And charity is that emotion in action. Somebody doing something for you that did not look for recognition, that came out of the blue or was known to you or was not even maybe even an enemy to you. But they provided something that you needed under a circumstance that you could not take care of yourself. And it wasn't, oh, this is an answer to my prayers, whether they all ultimately are, but that this act of charity was something that distinctly stands out in your mind and maybe shaped you a little bit.
Yeah, I would have to say it happened more than once.
Give me an instance that comes to mind that you've fallen back on and reminded yourself of a few times.
I remember feeling like when I was a really young man in my early 20s, I felt like quitting. I felt like that I was a Bible student. I was living in a rundown trailer next to an alligator-filled swamp and being broke. I had a job, but I had bills to pay, and I was broke. My brother was working hard. We were both working hard. We were rust-proofing automobiles, and we had no groceries. We had nothing to eat, and my brother and I, we were both Bible students, and one night we went to class, and we went to class hungry. And after class was over, we came home. We pulled up in our driveway at about 10:15 or 10:20 at night, and there was something on the front porch. And we got out of our car, and we walked up to the front porch, and lo and behold, there were about 8 bags of groceries on our front porch. And my brother and I, we just wept. We just stood there in the yard and just looked at those bags of groceries, and we just wept. We hadn't told a single, soul that we were broke and out of food. And I don't, to this day, do not know who did that for us. But I know to this day that I am so grateful for whoever did that for me, because it was at that moment that I realized you can't quit. Because tell anyone about this. And your brother didn't tell anyone about this. God in heaven knew the path that you were going to take. He knew where you would be years from now. And when I think about quitting today, I look back at that one incident when the mysterious grocery shopper left bags of groceries on my porch at a very point in my life when I was about ready to just quit.
That's interesting. These are the things that start to become prominent in our minds as we move down the right road and have put many yards, long, hard yards behind us on that path. Now, here's another one. Friendships. Mm-hmm. Do you have those count them on one hand friendships? And would you like to tell me about one or two?
Sure. Well, I'm talking to one of them right now.
I'd agree with that.
We've been down a long road.
Yeah, we've seen some things.
I would have to say that, a mutual friend of ours, John, I won't give his last name, has been a true friend to me through the years. I have those friendships, like you said, that I can count on one hand. And I'm trying to talk about this without getting too shook up. And but I look back over the last 35 or 40 years, and I can count on one hand the friends that have been with me and have stuck with me through the years. I feel that my life, my ministry, God's called me to a very a ministry much like, in at least in one way, I wish it was like his in more ways, but much like Paul the Apostle's ministry, in that I was a man that was constantly on the move. I never really let the grass grow under my feet very long. I've been all over the world, various lengths of time, Canada, Cambodia, North America, different places, pastoring, starting churches, missionary work. And I have friends that have stood by me and have said, you know, Billy, you know, if this is where God is leading you, then we're with you.
Absolutely.
And that means an awful lot to me. And, you know, John Kehill is one of those guys. I said I wasn't going to mention his last name, but I just did.
That's all right. You can do that.
He's been one of those guys that have just really been a true blue friend to me through the years. And I remember many times the three of us spent time drinking coffee and sitting in his house fellowshipping. And I just know that that's what friendship's all about. It's it's being faithful through the years. And that means an awful lot to me.
Okay, here's one of the last questions on what has been really enjoyable interview with you, making it as formal as this and not just me being your buddy and your longtime friend. There's a thing that pretty much an ingredient that's at the core of us, all human beings. I call it the human condition. Right. And what would you say the core ingredient is that describes you?
Steadfastness.
That was good. That was fast. You weren't fumbling around with that. And I concur. if there's anything that has inspired me over the years, it's, wow, Billy's there now. And look at the work he's doing. I believe it was 12 churches in Cambodia you started,
12, yes.
It? Yeah. And Montreal, a church that's still going now. I was there with you in it. Using some very bad French. I say so too. And you bailing me out. Yeah, I'll take that. And so steadfastness. And that's a great trait to have. Now here we come down to asking you take the leash off and you can talk about anything that's on your mind, that's on your heart, or that you're seeking to accomplish with your hands. Floor's yours.
Well, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to be on today. And I want to appeal to the other people that are listening to this podcast to consider joining me in prayer for my fellow Native Americans, First Nations, Indigenous people.
Absolutely.
We faced through the years and continue to face a lot of trials and struggles. But most of all, my people face a spiritual struggle. And we've been told over and over again that we can't be, quote, Indian, unquote, and be a follower of Jesus Christ. And I just totally reject that.
And I do too. I absolutely do.
And we've been
too.
Told that by our own people and by Christian missionaries. And I really believe, you know, a famous preacher said one time that Native Americans are a sleeping giant, and that one day he believes that the sleeping giant will awaken and will possibly be the evangelist, the catalyst that will bring another awakening to America before Jesus comes back. I dream for that.
That's a good dream.
If we're ever
going
to see a spiritual awakening among our people, we are going to have to stop doing what the Pharisees did to their people, where Jesus said they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne, and they lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. I think much of historical fundamental Christianity has laid heavy burdens on my people and made it hard to come to Jesus. And I believe that if we would just simply just get out of the way and let Native people, let God run things and let the Native people hear the gospel, I believe we're going to see a lot of my people come to know the Savior. I really do. And I just want to ask people to join with me and to intercede for the First Nations people of this continent.
Billy, thank you for letting me take you deeper on Fresh Oil.
Thank you, Billy.
And just to wrap it up, you have a website or anything, Billy, that I can post everybody on and let them know what you're
Billy
doing?
Billy Potawatomi. Let me spell that for you. The B-I-L-L-Y, P as in Paul, O, T as in Thomas, A as in Adam, W-A-T-O-M-I, BillyPotawatomi.tumblr.com. TUMBLR.com.
Good. And we'll post that on the site and we'll put some other notes that I've collected from around various resources that I know where you're at and let them point that towards you. And maybe there are some people that have a burden for those people as well. Might want to contact you and do something about that. I know that you're currently trying to buy a church.
I am trying to buy a church. I'm actually simultaneously planting two churches at once.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you're up in the Sault Ste. Marie
right
area, isn't it? And how much does that church cost?
It's got some problems, and so I think it's going to sell cheap. We're probably looking at anywhere between $45,000 and $60,000. And it's going to need a dry basement work done on it, if you know what that is. It's got mildew and mold in the basement.
Yeah. The laws now, you can't have things like that. They've got to go and clean all
so
that up.
So we're going to have that work done. And then
okay. Well, I wanted to get that.
We're looking
that
at another
there.
Piece of property too. It's all on one floor. It's an old government weather station, and it needs a little work too. But it might be an advantageous situation. A lot of Native Americans have diabetes and are in wheelchairs, and this one, the weather station actually might be a better fit for us because it's going to be easier for us to handicap access that one. So
I see.
Yeah, so we're just praying and asking God for wisdom and to lead us in the right direction.
Thank you, Billy. And folks, you'll get to freshoil.com. You'll be able to pick up the links to various places. But I know Billy's on LinkedIn, and I'm sure he has a Twitter handle. I'm sure he's got the Tumblr site. What's your Twitter handle,
Billy? My Twitter handle, I think it's Bill Haas, at Bill Haas.
Okay, well, I'll find all of that out. I wasn't for sure if there was a particular one, so I wanted
to wait. Automatically logged in, so I don't put it in. I just click it and it comes up.
Okay, we're definitely Philistines in an age of digital, that's for sure. Thanks, Billy. It's been great to talk to you. And we're going to wrap up the show now and say thank you very much. And that's a wrap.
You've been listening to Fresh Oil with Billy Delaney. Thanks for pressing play.